Hey guys, very proud to have Rick Rule. Someone I've followed and watched extensively is an incredible character, actually, I find on the web. Apart from that force of real credibility of knowing and having been there and done that, he's an absolute deep dive resources demon. He is also the ex-CEO of Sprott US Holdings, having sold numerous projects to them and actually one of their largest shareholders. Rick, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your great wisdoms in the resource space. Welcome.
A pleasure, sir. Thank you for having me on. I'll enjoy the opportunity to visit with your audience.
Awesome. Rick, we've had a kind of framing for the current market conditions, and wow, isn't it particularly salient that we're speaking right now as we have US indices spilling their guts, lots of what we call as technical analysts, head and shoulders, and there's kind of a fear trade on the one hand, and there's a little bit of the inflation trade on the other. We were allowed into the inflation trade for a while, and now we're getting this dollar dominance. How are you seeing positioning in all of this? Are you avoiding the ebb and flow between those two themes and just staying hard on the inflation on the basis that stimulus will come back?
You know, Francis, by training and by preference, I'm a credit analyst, which means that the work that I do is value-oriented and, by the way, determinedly contrarian. So my instinct now is very bullish. There are opportunities that I see that have been on my shopping list, but hitherto unaffordable as a consequence of the fact that they were on shopping lists of other people who were more generous than I. I need to say, it feels like going into these markets is akin to stepping in front of a freight train, which is never fun. Notwithstanding, my own discipline has told me that when high-quality companies are reasonable, you buy them. When speculations that you know better than other people are dirt cheap, you buy them. And when you absolutely are being rewarded for earlier having the courage of your convictions, which is to say when your positions rise and become popular, you sell them. And so I'm scaling into some assets. I wouldn't describe myself as having the guts currently to go all in, because in addition to the fact that the market conditions give one pause, the reasons for the fear trade, which is to say decreasing liquidity and a challenging macro environment, are very much alive. And some aspect of your net present value calculation has to do with discounting the downside on macros, which of course could go to the operating results of any company that you had the courage to buy. So I would describe the outlook from my own point of view as mixed, but I'm certainly attracted to the fact that some companies that I'm attracted to, not as a consequence necessarily of their stock market performance, but rather as a consequence of the juxtaposition between the net present value of their future cash flows and their current enterprise values, strike me as cheap. And that's always a good sign.
I like that. Knowing your price, trading to your price, if you were a technical analyst, you would be trading to the level, but those levels have been determined on fundamental, I suppose, cash generation through yields, earnings, and prospects for, I suppose, we're talking a lot in terms of precious metals and resources, possibly energies in there, Rick. What's your favorite categories? As we also, just before you answer that, it appears we might be setting up a unique scenario where there will be an absolute fire sale bargain opportunity at some point, maybe not too far away as well. So which of those industry and sectors and which of those companies, if you will?
In my declining years, Francis, I try to confine myself to investing areas where I believe I have a competitive advantage, an intellectual advantage over most of my competitors. So I confine myself to natural resources, which is to say precious metals and industrial materials, and conventional financial services, insurance businesses, banking businesses, businesses that I've engaged in for 45 years. Yeah. I constrain myself to those industries, not as a consequence really of market conditions, but rather because at age 69, I've become more and more aware of what I don't know. And what I don't know constitutes most of the investment landscape. I'm perfectly capable of making mistakes in industries that I know very, very, very well. And I doubtless could do almost incalculable harm if I got myself out of that sphere.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes absolute sense to complete competence. We're seeing, for example, First Majestic, which trade at 7.24 at the moment, a silver miner that you're probably fairly familiar with, both the CEO, Wheaton, which is one I like, falling to 38 at the moment as silver is coming down, kind of losing its ledge, could be a bit of a bull flag. I'll throw that in for the technical guys. I know that's not your bag. 20.64 on the silver. We're big accumulators and stackers on the base, similar principles that you've helped teach so many people. And thank you for that, by the way. Not enough people recognize the people that come out and talk truth in a perverse financial system. Thank you very much for that. At what point do you really say it's worth standing in front of that runaway train for silver trading if it goes below 20, for example, and some of those companies I mentioned?
So I think you've asked me three questions there, Francis. The first revolves around silver. My experience has been that silver is a late sector mover in precious metals, which is to say that the momentum must be established by gold.
Yes.
When that momentum has been established, it's been my experience that silver moves further and faster.
Yes.
And I don't know when we will reestablish traction in gold, although I believe that we will. I believe that gold is an investment, silver is a speculation. I'm both an investor and a speculator.
Yes.
I own some silver, but I'm overweighting gold to silver at present because I think the next move will be a fear move rather than a greed move.
Yes.
With regards to the two names that you mentioned, I was a founding shareholder of Wheaton Precious when it was Silver Wheaton. I have a very large position, bought at lower prices, and I'm eager to buy more. And I'm absolutely delighted to see the share price decline in Wheaton Precious because the stock that I own right now isn't for sale at any price like this. Given that I want to buy more, my interest is in seeing lower, not higher prices. And I'm almost certain that I'm going to be accommodated. Would I buy it today? Yes. Do I think I'll be able to buy it for less later? That would be my gut feeling.
Yes.
In the case of First Majestic, you have a very different circumstance. That you have a brilliantly constructed company over time with a mercurial and brilliant CEO. The challenge that you have is the operating results at Jerritt Canyon. And until they have dealt with the turnaround at Jerritt Canyon, by the way, I believe they'll do that. They're very good at buying undercapitalized, cash-starved assets, throwing the capital at them that they need to and turning them around. But until that turnaround in terms of cost and production is evident in the market, First Majestic is going to be challenged. It is true that fortune favors the bold. And if you have the courage of your convictions to buy the stock before the turnaround has occurred, you may be able to participate in a speculative bump. Given that my own background, Francis, is lending, I'm always leery about taking that speculative profit before it's been earned.
Correct. And just for the less well-informed of us, Terracan, Mexico, Chile, what segment of their portfolio are we talking about, part of the world?
Jerritt Canyon is a very, very, very large historic producing gold and silver mine located in the state of Nevada, which they bought from a private owner, Eric Sprott.
Gotcha.
First Majestic has done a really good job buying big, old, long-of-tooth mines whose prior operators didn't have the ability to capitalize them correctly.
Gotcha.
And First Majestic has done a very good job of employing both physical capital and intellectual capital to turn around these big, old behemoths. The Gotcha. Turnaround hasn't happened at Jerritt Canyon yet, and until that turnaround happens, mining investors will be leery about it. Speculators, of course, will not.
Yeah, got you. Yeah, so a little bit more unique, specific company risk
Correct.
There with
Correct.
Potential once there's clear material benefits. Doesn't price always fix a lot of those kind of problems as well, Rick? Especially
yes.
if you've got a real... That doesn't deal with operational issues at a management level.
Provided that you stay alive until the price increase happens. Our mutual Correct. Friend, Doug Casey, used to say, when the wind blows, even turkeys can fly. but you need to own well enough fed turkeys that they can survive until the wind blows.
Correct.
You know, one further comment I might give on First Majestic that most people don't recognize is the extraordinary investments that the company has made over the last decade in financial public relations. In addition to being a company, it's a cult. And what you see in a silver bull market is that there is no constituency in the world that is as interested in good results from First Majestic as First Majestic shareholders. It ends up being almost a lightning rod for sentiment around silver. So as silver catches a bid, I think you'll find most of the audience much less sensitive than I to the quarterly results at Jerritt Canyon. It's only an old lender that cares about stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, a smart one, I will say, with much years of experience. I also credit you with being one of the most foremost people that continued to drag uranium into people's consciousness. And literally, for me, we've seen a complete turnaround. I remember the whole story with, and it dates right back to Fukushima, when Germany declared that they would no longer utilize nuclear power, and nuclear was met this full force of demonization. And I'm sure this is real old hat and you recall it all, but I had enough of a watching remit, and I was quite stunned by this reversal, because I've always been under the impression that nuclear power, in truth, before the renewables, for which there's this huge credibility gap that we haven't filled yet for this entire transition to take place. People have underestimated the scale of the transition to renewables, and that the cleanest option actually is nuclear. And we saw uranium get totally, chastised and hated. And you spoke often about, I love the most hated. Take us through your experience with uranium from the dark days and how it looks, and then maybe your current feelings.
Well, you know, if you consider yourself to be a contrarian, sidebar, if you're a natural resource investor in capital-intensive cyclical businesses, my slogan is you're either a contrarian or you're going to be a victim. But if you are a contrarian, the fact that people are either bored by your thesis or better yet hate your thesis gives you a strange form of validation. When I first began speaking about the uranium sector, which was 1998, I was struck by the fact that after a 20-year bear market, it isn't that the sector didn't have any favor, that people were bored of it after a 20-year bear market because it hadn't performed. It was vilified. I would speak about the fundamentals of uranium in investment forums, and afterwards people would come up to me and say, you know, Mr. Rule, you are a truly despicable human being. You are seeking to profit on Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and Fukushima. Well, this is pre-Fukushima, so they leave Fukushima out. A couple interesting notes about that. 6 or 7 years after that, after I was proved to be right, those same people were asking me for stock tips, but that's a different question. When I looked at the uranium business, first in 1998, and then again in 2015, 2016, I was struck simply by the arithmetic. Despite the fact that people are concerned about uranium, most people in the world, if they have the option, when they walk into a room and flip a switch, want the lights to go on. and certainly in the Western world, that involves uranium. Very rich countries that allegedly can afford not to have uranium, like the United States, rely on it for 20% of their baseload power. Engineers tell us that a mere 3% redundancy, which is to say 103% availability relative to demand, is a small enough margin that you experience brownouts, revolving brownouts. Any number the lower than that, then you experience blackouts. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting baseline. If your baseload power is 20% meant by nuclear, and if the uranium price is selling for less than the cost of production, the only answer to that conundrum is that either the uranium price goes up or the lights go out. So in the year 1998, the arithmetic went like this. The incentive price for new production in uranium was about $30 a pound, and the stuff was selling for $8. The industry was producing 100 and something million pounds a year. They were losing $20 a pound, and being miners, they were trying to make up the losses on volume. It wasn't working. The conundrum was easy to look at. Either the price went up or the lights would go out. Those were the two choices. and I thought it more likely that the price would go up. Now, admittedly, in 1998, I was early, 4 years early, as a matter of fact. But the truth is that the move that I saw in the uranium price, which is to say from $8 a pound to $140 a pound, was so dramatic that the profits that took away any discounted net present value that might want, that one might have with regards to the time value of money, even at the higher interest rates that prevailed in 1998 to 2002. Fast forward to 2015, of course, the uranium business got slammed after Fukushima. And it got slammed too in what I would describe as a sort of a misguided rush to unknowing ESG concerns. The idea that power decisions would be made by a high school truant from Sweden, you know, certainly didn't help uranium in terms of the narrative. But the arithmetic was the same.
I'm not sure she did the same arithmetic as you either, given that she wasn't at school.
You know, she's a much better speaker than I, and she's, because she's an icon for a certain point of view, she is very good at some aspects of her craft. But I don't think that she spent very much time in math class, and I don't think she did any physics at all.
I don't even agree on speaking, but never mind. I'm a fan boy.
If you compare her audience to mine, I'm afraid that I come in third in a race of two. But at any rate, we're in a circumstance now where the incentive price for new production, given the inflation in the supply chain, is, in my opinion, somewhere between $70 and $75 a pound. Yeah. And we're producing the stuff at spot at about $50 a pound, meaning that the industry is still losing on a fully loaded basis, including the cost of production, about $20 a pound.
But meanwhile, so long. I mean, who's been throwing good money after bad for all these decades, Rick? I almost asked, well, why weren't they switched off? Is this government subsidization? Is something going on? How did that even happen? We should have had much more bankruptcies, although I am aware it's very small industry now. I think someone said the entire market cap of all uranium stocks, and it's probably me listening to you, is smaller than the market cap of Exxon or a comparable similar to that.
Well, that's interesting, too. Exxon makes more money than the entire uranium industry, so it makes sense that their market capitalization would be higher. To answer your former question, we developed in the 1970s massive oversupplies of uranium, oversupplies. And having developed those supplies, particularly where the supplies were state-controlled, Kazakhstan, Mongolia, Uzbekistan, Russia.
There was also the deal with Russia with the decommissioning of the nuclear weapons, and they had
I'll get to that.
Okay, that was a massive overhang, wasn't it?
We had massive oversupply, and state actors are unlikely to shut down oversupply if it is in their strategic or political best interest not to do it. The second thing that happened is that the most obscene oversupply that we had was in finished bomb grade fuel.
Yes.
There's an ugly, strange love phrase called overkill. An overkill is the amount of uranium necessary to kill every person on Earth once. It seems that the United States felt that its future was secure with about 1500 overkill. In other words, our inventory was enough to kill all of humankind 1500 times. The Russians were much more nervous than us, and my understanding is that the Russian overkill approached 11,000. Mercifully, I think, for humankind, in the 1990s, we decided that both sides would probably be safe with 100 overkill. And the United States and Russia began jointly decommissioning this weapons-grade fuel and taking it down to utility-grade fuel. Which
adding the tail back in and
had a huge multiplier, you know. A pound didn't become a pound became 2 or 3 pounds, which was a lovely circumstance. So we had a conjunction of oversupply, and put on top of that, we had this conversion of weapons grade, and so we had an enormous oversupply of uranium. When that gave way, of course, the uranium price absolutely soared. It absolutely spiked. And the consequence of that,
you described, from $8 to, I think, 140.
140.
Yeah, because that's a fabulous view. To be honest, a lot of our investors are, you know, we'd have a six digits aside for a good trade. That is a retirement and generational wealth trade in its own, isn't it?
Well, let's make it more extreme. If you take it from the yellow cake to the shares, at the beginning of that bull market, there were five uranium juniors in the world that had survived a 20-year bear market. Mercifully for me, I bought all five of them. The worst performer in the ensuing 6 years went 22 to 1.
Yeah.
The best performer went from 10 cents all the way down to a penny. Yeah. In other words, it fell in price by 90%. And then it went from a penny to $10. It went 10,000 to 1 in 6 years.
Wow.
So if you want a ridiculous story in terms of price performance, or for me, what was in fact a life-changing trade, that was certainly it. What happened partially as a consequence of that bull market is that markets worked, that people started looking for uranium, and in particular, the Kazakhs found it. Kazakhstan production increased by 1,000% over 7 years.
Yeah.
And that increase in supply occurred concurrently with the disaster at Fukushima, which took the second largest nuclear fleet in the world out of production, or out of consumption, pardon me. So classic supply-demand imbalance.
Spike up REM, and you had at the same time an absolute event demand killer that almost was looking only for substitutes and turned literally uranium into the neo-Nazi at the knitting class in terms of popularity. So yeah, that's fabulous. So obviously that then led to the next mega bear, and I'm assuming we were left with just five guys standing in the room that were as hardy as hell.
Well, this time through, I think about 20 made it.
20 made it.
That 20 has now become 75. Recently. as the sort of pretenders, the people whose companies failed at gold and they failed at pot, they've recycled them now as uranium companies. But we have a circumstance that is in some senses reminiscent of the past bull market, which is to say that the industry is in liquidation at the same time that the utility of the fuel is coming back into vogue. What's really changed now is two things. The first is very recent, which is to say the conflict in the Ukraine, where for geopolitical reasons, companies or countries, pardon me, are looking at energy security. Given the energy density of uranium, there's no fuel in the world that you can store such a small amount of, which will generate so much power over time. So if you're Taiwan, if you're Korea, if you're the United Arab Emirates, if you're Japan,
you don't have big space for storage and you need a real bang for your buck. It's got to be the only game in town. And now we're deglobalizing and we're saying we're not dealing with half the world. So we're cutting the supply chain, not even in half, because we've got to say a lot of those major energy players are on the wrong half as well, aren't we? So how does that leave us in the West? Who are the big providers?
Certainly geopolitically, what you have to understand is that while the Russians aren't huge suppliers of uranium, they're the dominant supplier of enrichment and fabrication. About 40% of enrichment worldwide takes place in Russia. And the cessation of Russia's ability to supply has brought energy security to the fore in another circumstance, which is to say the fragility of global supply chains. But the thing that might be more important than that has become the growing realization that if you look at the science, nuclear energy is an environmentally attractive alternative. So you have things like the government of the People's Republic of China saying, acknowledging that 500,000 people a year die in China as a consequence of airborne particulate pollution from power generation. And saying in terms of baseload power, their only alternative is nuclear. And even in Japan, where there was widespread public disgust with Fukushima, there is the growing realization that the only way that Japan Inc. can be powered in an environmentally sensitive way is nuclear power. And it will be the political acceptance of uranium in Japan allowing the pace of Japanese restarts that is the real catalyst for this bull market. It is important that the world is building nuclear power plants or financing them, which will impact demand 10 years from now. Japan will impact demand this year and next year. The restart of the Japanese nuclear fleet, well, that part is still shut.
In other words, their current contracts, are they having a bit of a cliff edge? Is there something that we should
know? No, everybody else has to build new plants. Yeah. The Japanese plants are built. Yeah. All they have to do is return to production. Correct. When they return to production, the inventory overhangs that are looked at the market now as available for sale become fuel. And yeah. You change the supply demand picture positive to the extent of 10 to 12 million pounds per year now, not at some time in the future when you've built a plant.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's going to get soaked up quickly as they re-engage. And what have they been doing for power generation? Let's use Japan as the microcosm. Surely they've not gone back to burning coal. What did they do?
Well, they in fact have gone back to burning coal, or pardon me, they neglected to shut down plants that they had earmarked for shutdown. But the most important thing that they did is they changed the dynamic of the seaborne liquefied natural gas market. The immediate impact of the shutdown of Fukushima was a quadrupling of seaborne liquefied natural gas. Now, the market began to accommodate that, and the price of liquefied natural gas on the seaborne market declined for a decade. That party, as you've seen, is over. The Japanese ability to substitute liquefied natural gas, seaborne liquefied natural gas, now that Russian gas supplies are shut off from Europe, that party came to a screeching halt.
Yeah. So if you have both a position in gas, you have some of the best gas providers. Is that specific to liquefied natural? Because the big problem with gas is its transportability. For those that are new and listening, I know you know that, and you'll teach us all about it. But it's all in the wrong place. America used to burn it off as waste product at one point. Now we've got Houston. Europe relies on it immensely and is currently facing a huge additional spike on their inflationary forces as a result of that reliance, and now is being pressed not to purchase Russian gas. So how does this all play out? Tie the gas and the uranium markets together. Basically, construct the trade. Is this still a great future for that possible 10x, 100x in uranium and or gas? How does it play out between the two? Because they are partial substitutes in a partial sense.
You know, I think the truth is that for various reasons, we'll need every form of energy we can possibly get in the future. Yes. We'll need solar, at least in that part of the world where the sun shines. We'll need wind where the wind blows. We'll need nuclear. We'll need coal. Many people don't realize the largest year for seaborne coal demand in history was 2021.
In South Africa, the Chinese have been taking all the best grade coal.
Sure.
And the South African government is using the low grade coal in Eskom and destroying their maintenance requirements and killing Eskom, and as a result of facing blackouts. So it's incredible what you say. The biggest year of 2021, I saw it going out to the ports.
Yeah. So the truth is that I think the entire raw materials complex will do well, except in the event of a worldwide recession or depression. It is very obvious to me that we're going to have supply challenges throughout many aspects of the resource business because of 2 to 2.5 decades of underinvestment by humankind in productive capacity. Absent a recession or depression, and right now, it's estimated that the global oil and gas industry is underinvesting in sustaining capital and new project investments by about $1 billion US a day. That impedes in the intermediate time our ability to produce. If you aren't maintaining a water flood, if you aren't drilling development wells, if you aren't completing the drilled uncompleted, the truth is, every day your business is in decline.
The cure for that is price. If people are underinvested because the returns.
We have a circumstance right now where the returns in the oil and gas business, the margins are the very best in my career. I've never seen them like today. But still, because the political and social outlook around oil and gas is so bad, the institutional investors in particular are insisting on decapitalizing the producers rather than investing. the governments around the world are making it more difficult to ensure oil and gas operations. It's more difficult to construct senior secured revolving lending facilities if you're a big chartered bank. And so despite the fact that the operating margins and frankly the future around fossil fuels is as bright as it's ever been, there are constraints on the supply and the availability of capital. And the consequence of that is that we're ironically prolonging a bull market in oil and gas, much to my delight. I'm an oil and gas investor, and the idea that I'm for once in my life being subsidized in a very perverted fashion by the political class is something that gives me no end of amusement.
Yes, I would find that most delightful and pleasurable and ironic. Are the people that are not actively engaged right now in uranium, natural gas, the energy complex, which seems to be the biggest driver and feeds through most into the inflation that we're all expecting, apart from demand being killed right now, for example, with a major stock market crash, a housing crash, and everybody being locked down again in winter potentially, or other if such events, which I don't think we're done with and will likely reemerge at some point. Apart from that demand killing event, are there any real risks to the downside? Or if people are taking a macro view, have they missed the bus? What's your take to someone who's thinking, should I have uranium or natural gas?
So I think in terms of oil and gas, the easy money was made 2 years ago when the price of oil in US dollar terms went briefly negative and hovered around $20 to $30 a barrel later. That was a very, very easy trade, a very easy trade. Most people didn't make it because easy trades are tough, perversely, for some people. But there's big money ahead of us. The truth is that the work that I have done suggests that the big publicly traded oil and gas companies in the United States in particular are discounting $70 oil and $4 gas in a world where we're experiencing $105 oil and $8 gas. In other words, there's a lot of room to come down. There are a number of companies out there that could easily fund their sustaining capital investments, which is to say, spend enough money to maintain their production while generating between an 8 and 15% distribution of capital annually back to shareholders by way of dividends and share repurchases. The idea that you keep the earnings at the corporate level the same for 5 years, while if you wanted to, you reduced your debt or you reduced your market capitalization or you dividended out a 15% compound yield, is silly. It's truly silly. Yes. And I would suspect personally that the energy industry is likely the least negatively affected by a recession or a depression, with the exception of air travel. The reason for that simply is if you talk to most of your listeners and you ask them how much their driving would be reduced or whether or not they would turn down their home thermostat very much relative to sacrificing other consumer expenditures first, I think what you'll find is that the demand for basic energy is much stickier than other forms of consumer good.
Yeah. Yeah, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So in your position, counseling a group of young, eager people that can see that whilst we're facing a few challenges now in the stock market and the tightening is likely to be until they break something, no doubt this time they've got Jay Powell has turned into James Bond and there's a license to kill. And we'll squeeze and squeeze until something breaks. That's going to create somewhat of a possible bargain entry. Where would people's money best be spent? Which equities would you say, hey, if this comes off another 10 or 15%, I'm in their arms, knees, and elbows?
First principles. And the very first principle is contradictory. Despite the fact that the purchasing power of your liquidity, which is to say your cash, is declining in all probability by 8.5% compounded, you have to have cash. I regard the fork on interest rate as an options premium on having the liquidity, which in the event of a massive sell-off would give you the tools and hopefully the courage to take advantage of that circumstance rather than being taken advantage of by it. So the first pillar of success as an investor or speculator, particularly in times like these, is liquidity.
Okay. Yeah,
you pick the form. You pick the form. For me, it's partly US dollars, it's partly gold, but it's important to have liquidity, I think. The second thing is that there is still so much, and maybe it's short-lived, confidence in the market and so much liquidity in the market that ironically, the more speculative aspects of the market are overpriced relative to the higher quality companies, which is to say there's still enough hopeful narrative in the market that the speculative sectors, relative to the risks that they pose, are overpriced compared to the highest quality investment companies. So I would say to begin your investment adventures in extractive industries with the highest quality companies, the companies with the longest reserve life indexes, the companies with the best balance sheets, the companies with the best interplay between the balance sheet and the income statement. Those companies have names. ExxonMobil would be an example. Chevron would be an example. Coming down the quality trail just a little bit in the United States, Occidental, Devon, EOG. In the mining business, I think that you look to, if you have the courage for some real political risk, Glencore.
That has quite a lot of South African, but it's Swiss-based, isn't it now?
It's Swiss-based. There's a lot of question as to how they came about owning some of the assets in Africa.
Yes.
I'm not smart enough to comment, but let's just say that that risk is there. Certainly, one would look at the BHPs and the Rios of the world.
Yeah.
I would argue that one needs to look at Vale. I think that you need to look at the basic strength of their iron business. But you need to look, too, at their holdings in the Sudbury Intrusive Complex in Canada and the increasing importance of both platinum group metals, cobalt and nickel.
Those are going to be big. And that brings us a kind of a little bit to battery, because everybody's going to be buying, everybody's meant to be spending $75,000, $125,000 on a new Tesla, which clearly isn't going to happen. There isn't bottomless demand for that. I'm kind of for the six-digit car. But anyway, we're going to do battery in the house. All of this is also meant to be coming. What's the key mineral? You mentioned cobalt. We've also heard there's more silver in that. Surely copper comes into this discussion as well. I'm interested and curious how you would steer people in terms of crossing the bridge into that EV world.
I am really interested in the investment theme around electrification, which I have been for 15 years. I don't consider EV to be the driver, except in the imagination of Westerners.
Right.
Your listeners would be interested, I hope, to know that 1.2 billion people on Earth have no access to basic electricity at all.
Yeah.
Another 2 billion people on Earth experience energy poverty, either intermittent energy or energy which is for them unaffordable. We've done a wonderful job in humankind in the last 30 years of lifting the fortunes of the poorest of the poor. And the continuation of that trend, the fact that 3 billion people on Earth want to live like you and I, they won't get there in a generation, but they'll get closer. And the ability of humankind to lift the poorest of the poor in terms of their material living standards will dwarf, I think, the importance of the electronic vehicle. Clearly, Tesla is not going to build a whole network in Malawi. That isn't going to happen. But I think that we will, over 15 or 20 years, expand electrification to functionally every human being on Earth. That requires copper. It requires all kinds of things. And increasingly, too, the function of the grid with the increasing importance of renewables means that remote storage, which is a fancy way of saying batteries, are going to become more and more and more important. And there will be several battery technologies that will take hold depending on the function. But the whole complex around electrification and storage, I think, will be an important theme. And I don't think it'll be an important theme for 2 years. I think it'll be an important theme for 30 years.
Yeah. That chart's the cobalt chart that you've just mentioned, by the way. And it's broadly a line that goes from bottom left corner to upper right, just for people's frame of reference. Again, have they missed the bus at $40? Yes, if you were thinking 14 was your entry point in 21, which was only a year ago. But in terms of the macro, what's the biggest hound in a product that's required that has to be found? Is cobalt one of them?
Lithium? I think what holds cobalt back, ironically, is supply. There are several fabricators who have told me, if you could triple cobalt supply, you could triple the price. They are nervous about developing fabrication technologies around cobalt because they're concerned about the stability of supply. Let's look where cobalt comes from. One would have said 3 years ago that the most stable country in the cobalt chain was Russia.
Yeah.
That would have been a mistake.
Yes.
Alternatively, it comes to you from Congo,
yeah.
A country that's perhaps improving, but from an extremely low base.
What the hell, Bitcoin?
Pardon?
The car. I maybe got my Congo and my car mixed up. Yeah, sorry.
So stability of supply is a real issue. If you don't develop alternative supplies, I think that the high price begins to get in the way, because I think that you find fabrication technologies that substitute other materials for cobalt. You know, markets do work. And if that chart goes too far from the lower left to the upper right, what happens is two things. You find a way to develop supply at the same time that you find a way to curtail demand. But certainly with current technology, particularly with the shutdown in terms of tradability of Norilsk, that is the Russians' inability to ship cobalt, or if they do ship it, to get paid for it, you have problems. You also have legitimate ESG problems around the cobalt production chain in Congo. There is, in fact, child labor employed in the Congolese cobalt mines. Most of the cobalt in Congo comes from real formalized mines, but there is a substantial amount of production that is, from an ethical point of view, challenged. Now, some people would say that those very young people are working in the cobalt mines because their alternative is starvation. And that needs to enter into the discussion too. Cobalt's a challenging subject.
Irritation nonetheless.
For most people, not speculators, as investors, I think that you look at electrification in the copper market, which is a very big, very broad market, and in the nickel market. I think that you understand too that ironically, steel is an electrical metal, because everything that you build in terms of the electrical infrastructure requires steel. And I think that we misunderstand as an economy the importance of the increasing fortunes of the poorest of the poor in terms of how that will impact steel demand.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually, the play for cobalt, what you're saying in essence is it's almost too tight a market to be allowed to fully grow. It's kind of like a stock where there's not enough issuance. There's only,
I remember being schooled on cobalt by the commodity supply director for Toyota, who sat me down and said, I would easily pay twice as much for cobalt if you could triple the supply. But as it sits right now, we can't incorporate cobalt into our fabrication technology because we're unsure where we would get the cobalt if we increased utilization. That was stunning to me. I always thought of resource businesses.
The greater the supply, the lower the price. Actually, the take-up would be far larger. It could scale. It lacks the scale. And you made that point very, very well. You actually mentioned Russia a couple of times. There's a JP Morgan Russia fund that goes by the name of JRS. I'll also, just so that you can see where it is, this is not a technical question, you're not that man, but I'll just show you the chart. This is as a result of events in the war. Have we been given, now I don't know the actual constituents, I have to get the Google up again, but have we been given a bargain basement potential moment? Plus there's further equity selling off, there's going to be a liquidity crisis. I think it could dip a little lower, so I'm not calling a bottom. Generally, traders always want to buy these falling knives all the time. But in terms of Russia and some of the things they've done, the fact that they are debt-free as a fiat currency, they're probably a better although not as well proliferated one as the dollar and the euro, in terms of the gold backing, the resources, the energy. They're seeing positions for the inflation era, the energy era, and the resources era. Is this, outside of being specific on the individual components, is Russia itself generally not a great buying opportunity in all the different major companies?
Individual investors need to ask themselves the moral question. I don't want that question answered for me either by my government or by the media. But individual investors need to ask themselves the moral question about whether or not they want to invest in Russia. So I'll leave that one to individual investors, just as I don't want to be counseled by the great unwashed. I don't want to counsel anybody. With regards to price levels, I think that what you need to say about Russia is that it's probably the greatest resource bargain of my lifetime for money that you can afford to lose all of. This is a circumstance where 10,000 people, the Politburo, attempt to navigate every question on Earth for 100 and something million people. That's inherently unstable. And the Russians, in my experience, internally have a distressing habit of solving disputes with, 120 grains of lead at 1,800 feet per second through the temple. It is actually a difficult place, in my experience, to do business. If you're an American right now, the only way that you can buy the Russian stocks is by opening an account with Pictet or someone in Switzerland and affecting those transactions on the Moscow exchange. Will our government prosecute us for doing that? Will the Russians decide to confiscate assets owned by Americans in Russia? With Russia shut out of the SWIFT banking system and unable to pay us dividends, will the Russians, as they have suggested they're going to do, initiate dividend reinvestment programs so that at least we can use the accumulated dividends to buy more stock? Different question. The Russian resource stocks were already the cheapest resource stocks on Earth.
Correct.
They are mostly unavailable to Americans now, and I would suggest mostly unavailable to most Western investors. But their indicated prices have fallen fairly substantially. What's fallen even more is, of course, the liquidity. You aren't getting, I would suspect, real pricing signals where the stocks used to trade in the US over-the-counter market and they would trade like water in London. And now they trade sporadically in Moscow. Yeah. So I would say it's probably the greatest bargain in my lifetime, but it's only accessible for people who are willing to use money that they could afford to lose all of in circumstances that they don't understand. Yeah. I happen to be one of those.
Yes, and so do I. And I accept that risk. And I also think, unfortunately, in the West, rather than differentiating ourselves from some of those risks, we seem to be moving a lot closer to replicating some of those risks. And that's not being reflected truly in our pricing. We've seen the rule of law. I had a very interesting gentleman, John Titus, on, who is a litigator for patent law. And he says he is watching and recording the decline in the rule of law in the Western systems. And he was giving us each of, and I won't get all legal on it, but it was a fascinating watch. And that is supposedly the big narrative for West. A, you have the dollar, this benchmark, this custodian of global currency that everybody accepts, and the rule of law, property law, the right to own things, and all sorts of things. And we're watching this. This won't come as a surprise to you, but I'm just curious on your comments on that, because I actually think there's a possible re-risking up on the West, and the scope actually that it maybe will be less bad on the other side. In other words, the legacy communist nations are assuming some degree of capitalism, and then unfortunately the legacy capitalist nations are tipping very deeply Bolshevik communist, and actually there's a mispricing in the relative ratings. And that doesn't mean I'm saying there's no risk in Russia. Everything you said, I 100% agree. It should be money you prepared to lose.
I would only agree with half your thesis. I think the communist countries are getting worse, and the allegedly free countries are getting worse even faster, albeit from a different start. Certainly, the suggestion about the rule of law has to be problematic. I would argue that for most investors, the most dangerous government to you is the government that's closest. When I think about the real risk that Mr. Putin faces me, other than doing something stupid with a red button, the truth is that he doesn't propose to charge me any tax. He doesn't propose to impose any regulation on me. He doesn't even know that I exist.
Yes.
By contrast, I'm terrified about Mr. Biden. And before that, I was terrified about Mr. Trump, because they could impact my lifestyle directly. The idea that I should be more concerned about Putin than Biden or Trump seems to me sadly comical, because he doesn't have the ability to affect my lifestyle very much unless he hits that damn button. Certainly, I believe that political risks are increasing as society becomes more politicized, to the extent that as people, we engage in voluntary trade with each other, where we need to convince someone else to buy our product, and where price discovery takes place in a free and open fashion, good things happen. But governments don't convince. Governments coerce.
Yes.
And those are very different circumstances where groups of people begin to enforce their will on others through government action. The inevitable result of that is the degradation of the rule of law, and by the way, increasing violence in society, where various parts of society believe that they're entitled to benefits which are owned by others, and they use the force of the state. The state, of course, having a legal monopoly on fraud and extortion, to exact their preferences. And I'm very concerned about that.
What should people do about this devastating trend? Let's just forget about it.
I think you have to take care of yourself, first of all. I think to the extent, you know, people have told me for years, well, Rick, you took so many risks starting your own business. Well, not as much risk as working for somebody else and then relying on Social Security.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that you believe, first of all, that you have a call on the collective is morally wrong.
Yes.
But it's also dangerous. The idea that you rely on the state, or for that matter, even on your employer for your retirement, is stupid. You need to take control of those things which are important to you. That's I think, the first thing. The second thing, and Buffett says this well, the best form of a hedge against inflation is to learn how to do something better than your competition. If you have a way to deliver value to your customers that's competitive in any pricing scenario in the world, you will do well, and you will certainly do better than your competitors will. So irrespective of the macro that you see, improve yourself, improve your ability to deliver superior value to your customers, whoever your customers might be.
Yeah.
Most people don't want to do that. Most people sort of, you know, want a weatherman to tell them which way the wind is blowing, so that they can stand in it. And that's problematic. I think self-reliance would be the broad catch-all for everything that I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming you will have some children and family and descendants. How are you guiding them? Because some of this, I feel, the apex of this loss of rule of law, and this is more of a reset discussion than your industry knowledge, excuse me. How do we set them up?
Well, the first thing I'm doing perversely is telling them to be optimistic. If you pay too much attention to everything that's going wrong, you pay no attention to what's going right. I've had the good fortune to be brought up in the United States, which, despite all of its flaws, is still an enormously creative society. It's still a place where 5 or 6 pimply-faced kids can commandeer a garage in Sunnyvale, and out pops Google or Apple or something like that. And the really, really, really good news, Francis, is that with increasing technology and the democratization of technology through communications, that it's very likely that that garage is going to be in Lagos or Nairobi or La Paz or Jakarta. The authors of that good fortune aren't going to look like you and I necessarily. Another good piece of news, which is related to that, is inclusion. Some men are going to hate me for saying this, but the idea that over the last 40 years we've decided to include half of humankind, which is to say the female half, in value creation. You know, value creation occurs independently of one's plumbing. And so I'm delighted to say that when I look out 10 years or 20 years, I believe that somehow our individual creativity and tenacity will likely amortize our collective stupidity. I'm not sure. But the truth is, if you allow yourself to be frozen, if you allow yourself to be frozen by fear,
you got nowhere.
The famous American basketball player said he missed every shot he didn't take.
Yes,
you miss. And if you allow yourself to be frozen by fear, you don't stand a chance of succeeding.
Yeah, there's a high number of people that just think the only way the overextension of government finishes is that they have to pursue it till its nth degree and break everything. A bit like what we were also saying about the Fed tightening cycle, although I think that'll come quickly, a lot quicker. It's almost once people smell power, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And that whole notion is, it's almost, we have to prepare them also for that. And within that to say, but you retain your mental health by seizing the opportunities at a local level and even at a provincial level and not being overly dominated and finding a way. Because there's always cracks and crevices, even inside a total grid of surveillance finance through your devices and all of that. So that's the optimism, I suppose. And there's also going to be extreme opportunity because most people are docile, as you've also suggested. You know, you didn't build the wealth you built by accident. You went out there and you scratched a hole in the ground. You asked questions. You got science on your side, and you built businesses and did something incredibly useful for other people and provided resources. And I think if you have that mindset, you're a winner and you will continue to win. And that's just the nature in which your win might adjust somewhat. So you're right about the optimism. Let's talk about precious metals, because we've done quite a bit on the energy. You mentioned your very great active involvement in Wheaton. Silver selling off, kind of it feels like a little bit of a bear flag. That's a technical comment. Don't worry about it. Tell us, the other key point you did say is gold first, moves first, and that's why you're overweighting gold in this contractory period. Second stage is when your lottery ticket really comes in with the silver ounces. Are there any equities that you could that you like that should be bought if we are blessed with a bargain basement market coming?
Well, I think the higher quality ones are uniformly cheaper than the speculative ones. So,
ironically,
you know, I would probably start the acquisition. Well, I'd probably start the acquisition by buying silver itself.
Yes. Do you think the commodity outperforms the equities, or do the equities?
No, I don't. I think that the commodity performs first.
Yeah.
And it performs with the least risk.
Yes.
And so, you know, sometimes capturing market beta cheaply at low risk is preferable to generating alpha, which may or may not occur.
Absolutely.
So I would start probably, if I thought the silver price is going to go up, which I do, by owning silver itself, rather than a security, which could be regarded as a derivative. In terms of the securities, I like the higher quality ones. The highest quality one that I know of is Wheaton Precious, although it's gold dominant, not silver dominant. Yeah. I'm attracted as a speculator to Pan American Silver because they have two deposits in the company, which for political reasons, they aren't able to start or restart, each of which is a half a billion ounce deposit of high grade silver. Either of those deposits, where they put in production, would double Pan American's production. So I'm attracted to that. I have this unbelievable upside that I see for free. The knocks on Pan American are real. They've had some misses, and they've had some misses largely as a consequence of the changing politics and sociology of both Peru and Mexico, where they're big producers.
Yeah.
Another stock that I like as a speculator that's sold off extensively is Hochschild's. Hochschild's has sold off really as a consequence of internal problems to Hochschild's and the declining political and social situation in Peru. What I sort of like about Hochschilds is that hidden in there, there's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful battery metals and rare earth deposit that I would suggest is getting no benefit at all in the Hochschild share price. Yeah, you need to be willing to take Peru political risk, which I think is interesting. Two other silver stocks that are useful for speculators. One, you really, really, really have to have guts for this, is Polymetal, the great Russian gold and silver producer, probably the highest quality silver producer in the world. I'll leave the Russian risk to your viewers. A second is a sort of a proxy Russia risk, which is KGHM, the great Polish.
Can I slow you there and just show Polymetal so that people can see the effect of that Russian risk as per the conflict right now? Yeah. You did, in fact, get close to, I'm assuming this is rubles because it's MOEX, Moscow Exchange, 2082, now trading 659 and yep. Throwing it down. And I'm desperately short of bidders. Do you know anything about its operational, given that that's
a lot.
Very
difficult? A lot. Oh, really? I was in, I probably shouldn't admit this. I'm still in contact with the middle managers at Polymetal. I haven't seen recent quarterly data, but I think it's selling at about 1.5 times EBIT.
Which is ridiculous.
Which is insane, given a sort of a 12 to 15 year reserve life index. Easily the cheapest high quality silver company on the planet, but with obvious political and social risk.
And the demand for silver, because so many people talk about, you know, have we ever had a true price discovery mechanism? And in, you know, the whole market fixing argument, and is it within their interest to hold back gold and silver, etc., which I think it largely has been. Where's the physical demand? How have they been able to keep it so low? How have we not had shortages? How come we just plain haven't had silver shortages?
Two things happened. For 20 years, industrial demand was curtailed because of the cessation of demand from photography.
Yes, Polaroid.
On the investment side, the truth is that we've just lived through the 40 most benign years economically that humankind has enjoyed. Given that in some senses, silver is an anti-dollar proxy, given that we've been in a 40-year bull market for the dollar and a 40-year bull market for bonds, of course, silver, parenthetically, got its ass kicked. I think that's over. I think we have a circumstance where negative real interest rates impede investors' and savers' faith in fiat-denominated savings instruments in favor of other assets, including gold and silver. On the industrial side, it's interesting to note that the reflective silver properties of silver means that if you are a believer in solar power, and I am, by the way, in the correct applications, that the most direct beneficiary of that is silver. Without the reflective qualities of silver, you don't have solar panels.
And conductivity, yeah.
What people are neglecting with regards to silver is it's also a spectacular germicide. And the utilization of silver in industrial capacities around water treatment and wastewater treatment on the one hand, and then medical sterilization on the other hand, are leading to very rapid increases in silver demand. And it's important to note that unlike photography, that stuff doesn't recycle very well. In photography, you could reclaim a lot of the silver used in processes. But if you're using silver as a biocide in water treatment, or I suspect if you're using very small amounts of reflective silver on a massive solar panel, that your ability to recover that silver economically, particularly in the context of today's silver price, means that this silver doesn't constitute reuse supply. The silver, in fact, goes to silver heaven over time.
Yes.
So I see increasing utilization of silver in terms of fabrication technologies. But I also, and I have no facts to support this, only anecdotal evidence from past bull markets, note that the second half of a precious metals bull market becomes silver-centric. And I believe that we're heading into a rip-roaring precious metals bull market.
Yeah. So first half gold, start with silver, then roll into a couple of equities. The biggest runners invariably the marginal equities. But you were pointing out that the quality is actually underpriced in the quality equities. So start there.
That's what I see. I mean, if you want some speculative names, I think you go to the highest quality spec names. So you go to the Silver Crests, you go to the Mags, you know, you go to companies with very high quality development opportunities, particularly given that they've sold off so aggressively. But I note that for the first time in my career, early in a bull market, the high quality companies are relatively cheaper than the low quality companies. Something that my age is absolutely delightful.
I can imagine. Absolutely. And with this, do you have an opinion on outside? So you're very clear on where you believe you have a competitive advantage and you stick to it rigidly. And I admire that. Be good at doing one thing well. It's always the specialist that makes the money, the brain surgeon over the paramedic. But the equity markets generally at an index level, do you even have an interesting view? Because they seem to be having not enjoying what the Federal Reserve has planned for them in terms of interest rate tightening, particularly that on the tech side. Do you have a view that we may indeed be tipped into a summer of discontent in terms of a feel-good factor on the asset category such as housing and wealth effect of the stock market, very significant for our American and UK audience particularly? And how does that feed through into the opportunity that some of the things we're discussing to pick up a little bit lower, or general economic comments as a result of this asset shrinkage and revaluation process that we may be experiencing?
I think we may have a decade of discontent. in the first instance, we're coming off the 40 most benign economic years of my life.
Alcohol stocks.
and you know, we're comparing the future with a past that was perfect, and perfect is difficult to continue. The other comment I would make is maybe less pedantic. As interest rates increase, the cost of capital to companies increases, which means that their margins decrease. At the same time that the capitalized value of distributions, which is to say dividends, decreases. Yeah. So the tailwinds that equity markets enjoyed from declining interest rates are, I think, in the near term over. And yeah. I think that we have ignored the impact of the circumstance on equity prices more than we should have. I'm speaking from a very broad point of view because I don't understand most industries and I don't purport to be an expert in them. But I do note that if the capitalized values of the distributions go down at the same time that the margins decline, one would suspect that that wouldn't have a beneficial outcome for equities.
An uglier outcome
for debt.
Yeah, an ugly outcome for debt, bonds going down, and a crushed retail consumer as well, buying less, demanding less. We kind of had this globalization boom where they got to inflate lots of asset bubbles by artificially low interest rates because we could source to the lowest common denominator, children in India stitching Nike footballs and boots, etc., instead of being made at home, all of these kind of things. And now that was kind of the Greenspan miracle economy. And now we have our the day suddenly meets night, the inverse Greenspan economy, where you almost have a hyperstagflation, where you're going to have stubbornly very high inflation rates, probably to some people actually in double digits. Shadow Stats has it at around 16, while we're sitting on BLS 8%. And you're also within that going to have a consumer that is hyper squeezed on account of disposable income. And you're going to have these super high input costs and all of this. Is metals for this hyperstagflation, are we looking in the right place? Obviously, debt is a non-buyer because they're going to maintain a negative real interest rates generally, even though they're talking about raising it. So you stay out of debt. It's almost the short. But are we in the right place, energies and metals as the longs? Or are there other industries that do well in this environment, which is rather negative?
I think we're in a place, but I think well-constructed financial services businesses will continue to do well. I know that whenever I've been involved in starting a bank, and I've done a few of them, that in terms of growing the bank, we did better in difficult economic times than we did well in disruptive periods. Let me say that.
Gotcha.
I think the insurance business is going to be an incredible business simply because there is going to be an increasing trend by government to shed risk, and the risk is going to have to find its home in insurance pricing. And there are whole new insurance classes around, as an example, environmental bonding and remediation, around ESG concerns that are going to open up. I think that an aging population in the West likely continues to bode well for medical technologies and pharmaceutical stocks, although I don't know a damn thing about them, you know, to be honest with you. But I think the biggest surprise to the upside is going to occur from increasing education levels in frontier and emerging markets. I think what's going to save us old, fat, bald white guys, frankly, is going to be young people in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. I think that the increase in the material well-being of humankind has been facilitated by technology, and the distribution of technology has been facilitated by communications technology. The idea that the most rapidly growing peer-to-peer fintech technology in the world is taking place in Central Africa is something that gives me enormous, enormous hope. I know I do a lot of outreach and mentoring to young people around the world, and I can say categorically that the most fun I'm having doing that is with aggregations of young people, say, in Goma, in Congo. And when I come away from these discussions with young people, allegedly me teaching them, the further thing actually from the truth,
you feel it.
When I come away from that, I say, you know what? As bad as it is, these kids are going to save my old ass. If I had my choice between young market ladies on a dirt crossroads in Africa or the big thinkers in academia and government in the West, please, please, please give me the market ladies.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Rick, this has been fantastic. I love it. And I think you're right. By the way, take a look at Charles Hoskins of Cardano. He's targeted Africa and education and bringing everyone board into the blockchain, if you have time. Thanks so much. It's been a real, real eye-opener. We truly appreciate it. How do people engage with you? I think you may even have an event. This is your minute. Tell us all about how do people get involved and find you.
Well, the easiest way to find me is my website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com. And I will incent people to do it, as is my wont. If you really care about resource investments, you care most about your own. And if you go to that website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, and list your natural resource stocks, I personally will rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. If I feel that my comments on individual issues might have value, I will append those comments to your stocks. I'm celebrating retirement. I'm 69, by starting a new bank. It's something I've done from time to time in my life when I saw a need. If people are interested in a real bank, you know, one that has money in it, one that loans against hard collateral like precious metals, in the question and comment section at ruleinvestmentmedia.com, add the word bank. You know that I have many educational products around, the most exciting of which in the near term is a live conference, which will take place in Boca Raton, Florida, between the 26th and the 29th of July. You can get information from there from me for there for saying conferences. And if you don't feel or can't come to Boca Raton, there will be a virtual conference which will accommodate it. So if you are interested in that educational product, simply say conference. By the way, all of my educational materials, those that I charge for, like conferences, come with a no questions asked 100% money back guarantee. If you don't think the price of admission to the virtual conference or the live conference, if you don't think that it was worth your while, let me know. I'll give you your money back. The financial risk is mine.
Absolutely. What a kind offer. Let me make sure I found the right website. I actually want people to see the site, know that they found their way. But I ended up on Sprott Media LibSync. So I think I've made an error here, Rick.
No longer Sprott Media. Rule Investment Media is the place to go. Yes, if you go to that, if you go further down that, it'll describe me as a billionaire, which I need to say, except for the Zim dollars, I'm not.
Oh, well, you can always buy the other half of Twitter and then troll Elon Musk. Oops, sorry about this. There we go. And there's the man himself with a blue banner. Excellent. Great. Rick Rule, so much value there. Some great names mentioned. We truly appreciate it. If you're in the Florida area or you're in the States, anyway, what's a short tour flight? Go chat with them. Go to the website, fill in your name. If you add the word bank, apart from getting your resources stocks rated, you will also be kept up to date with a real bank that has real collateral in this world. As precious metals is it is money, everything else is currency. Thank you so much, Rick. Have a great weekend ahead, and we appreciate having you on.
A pleasure, sir. Thank you.
All the best. Bye-bye.